Imagine you're on admitting service. It's 3 a.m. The patient in bed 7, an 85-year-old, is acting a little off, according to the nurse. No fever, no cough, no clear symptoms. Your gut says something's wrong, but what? And, well, where do you even start looking? Welcome to the deep dive from 88 Diagnoses. This is where we transform complex medical literature into clear, actionable insights for you, the busy learner.
And today, we're embarking on a really crucial deep dive. It's a topic that challenges even seasoned clinicians. The unique approach to infection in older adults. You know, it's a leading cause of death and morbidity, yet it often presents so deceptively.
Yeah, absolutely. We've pored through sources like Approach to Infection in the Older Adults to bring you the essential nuggets of knowledge. Our mission today is to arm you with the awareness and the tools to confidently manage infections in your older patients, helping you spot those subtle clues that others might miss.
Okay, let's unpack this. So when we talk about infection in older adults, it's immediately clear they're often more susceptible and their infections can be, well, far more severe. But why is that? Is it simply about age or is there something deeper going on?
Oh, it's definitely deeper. The foundational layer to understand is immune senescence.
Immune senescence, okay.
Yeah, it's a fundamental alteration in both the quantity and quality of their immune responses. This isn't just some vague decline. It means changes at multiple levels. It effectively weakens their body's ability to fight.
So it's not just a slower response, but actually a less effective one, too. What does that look like, say, physiologically?
Precisely. So first, their physical barriers are often compromised. Think about changes in their skin. It can be thinner, more fragile.
Or alterations in the respiratory and GI tracts. These are, you know, the very first lines of defense. And when they're weaker, it's simply easier for pathogens to get in.
Okay, so their body's natural fortifications are literally less robust.
That's a really good way to put it. And beyond that, at the cellular level, we see significant shifts both in cellular and humoral immunity. There are decreases in specific immune cell populations, and the cells they do have show a reduced ability to multiply and respond.
Wow.
We also see decreased production of critical cytokines like interleukin-2 or IL-2. These are essential for the immune system's sort of command and control center.
Oh.
So it impacts how effectively they coordinate a defense.
So fewer cells and the ones they have aren't communicating or reproducing as effectively. That sounds like a profound systemic weakness.
It is. And it gets even more specific when we look at, say, their vaccine responses. Antibody production after vaccination is often reduced.
Which is a huge issue.
A huge issue.
Yeah.
And it's linked to changes in structures like toll-like receptors, which are crucial for recognizing invaders, and to the aging of CD8 cells, reductions in naive CD4 and B cells, and impaired immunoglobulin production. The cumulative effect is just a broadly weakened immune system that really struggles to mount an effective targeted response.
Okay, so beyond the immune system itself, what about other health conditions? Or, you know, external factors, do they play a big role?
Absolutely. Underlying chronic diseases, comorbidities, they're a huge factor. Conditions like diabetes, COPD, heart failure, they're just isolated issues.
Right.
They fundamentally impair immunity. They further increase susceptibility to common infections.
Yeah.
And interestingly, they worsen vaccine responses too.
It's like a house with a weakened foundation. Any storm just hits harder.
Exactly. You know, when you're on the wards, you often see patients with that long list of comorbidities. It's easy to focus on their cardiac issues or their diabetes, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this really drives home how those conditions fundamentally weaken their defense against infection.
That makes sense. And what about where older adults live? I imagine that makes a difference too.
Well, it does. Environmental factors, particularly the communal settings like nursing homes, assisted living facilities, even senior daycare programs.
Yeah.
They inherently carry a heightened risk of infection, just due to close proximity and shared environments. So it's really a multi-pronged vulnerability that we as clinicians need to keep top of mind.
Okay. If you can't remember everything from this section, remember this. Older adults are inherently more susceptible to infection and have poorer outcomes due to immune senescence, compromised physiologic barriers, chronic diseases, and often communal living. Now, here's where the clinical picture gets, well, really challenging. We're all taught the classic presentations for infections like pneumonia or a UTI. But in older adults, those textbook rule books often seem to get thrown out the window. How different can it really be?
Oh, it can be dramatically different. Older adults can have severe, even life-threatening infections without any of the typical signs or symptoms we'd expect in younger adults.
Really? No fever at all?
They might lack fever entirely, or even specific localizing symptoms. Take pneumonia, for example. Instead of that high fever, productive cough, pleuritic chest pain.
It's a classic triad.
Right. Instead, pneumonia might just manifest as maybe a low-grade temperature elevation to 99 degrees AFA. That's 37.2 degrees C, and maybe an increased oxygen requirement. It can be incredibly subtle.
Wow. So no screaming red flags from the usual suspects. What are the other, maybe more subtle clues that should raise our suspicion for infection then?
Well, you'll often see more nonspecific symptoms, things like new onset confusion, maybe increased falls, or anorexia.
Okay.
Now, here's a crucial insight. While these symptoms are common in older adults, they also have a low positive predictive value for infection.
Ah, okay. That's important.
Very important. They do not, by themselves, automatically necessitate empiric antibiotic treatment.
But that's such a critical point. I've definitely heard attendings caution against immediately reaching for antibiotics when a patient is just confused. Mm-hmm. So instead of immediate antibiotics for isolated confusion, what should we do first?
Right. So those nonspecific symptoms should first prompt a thorough physical exam. You're really looking to elicit any localizing signs. Then, a careful medication review is essential.
Med review, right.
And consider other diagnostic tests or even just supportive measures, like ensuring adequate oral hydration. You're looking for the new and specific changes rather than just a general feeling of offness.
Okay, that makes sense. So if confusion alone isn't enough, what does prompt an urgent evaluation for infection? What are the real red flags we should look for?
The presence of a new fever, hypothermia relative to their baseline, new or worsening delirium, or new onset hyperglycemia. Those should definitely trigger an infection evaluation.
Got it.
But remember, behavioral changes by themselves do not require an exhaustive workup for infection. And importantly, if you do start empiric treatment based on suspicion, it is critical to discontinue it promptly if the diagnostic tests come back negative.
Right. De-escalation is key. And what if the patient has cognitive impairment, like advanced dementia? That must make communicating symptoms even harder.
Oh, it absolutely does.
Yeah.
Patients with cognitive impairment really struggle to communicate symptoms effectively. So this means clinicians might need a lower threshold for objective assessments.
Like labs or imaging.
Exactly. Like sending labs or ordering radiology. However, and this is important, this still doesn't apply to isolated new onset behavioral symptoms without other localizing signs or delirium.
Okay.
You still have to carefully consider non-infectious etiologies first in those cases.
And the gold standard, fever itself, you mentioned they might not even have one. Our definition of fever needs to shift for older adults, right?
Precisely. For frail older adults, fever is actually absent in something like 30 to 50% of serious infections.
30 to 50%? Wow.
Yeah, it's significant.
Yeah.
This blunted febrile response is due to impairments in their thermoregulation systems.
Yeah.
So yes, we absolutely need to adapt our definitions.
Okay, give us the numbers. What's considered a fever now in this population? What should we be looking for?
Okay, so for frail older patients, a fever can be defined as a single oral temperature greater than 37.8 degrees C at high. That's on average affair.
Okay, 100F.
Or a persistent oral or tympanic membrane temperature equal to or greater than 37.2 degrees C. That's 99.0 AIF.
99. Okay.
And critically, even a rise in temperature of 1.1 degrees C, which is about 2 degrees AFN, above their baseline temperature can be significant, even if it doesn't actually hit 100 degrees AFN.
That baseline comparison is key.
Absolutely key.
And hypothermia, that's also a grave sign, isn't it? Not just the absence of fever.
Oh, absolutely. It signifies severe infection, potentially sepsis. Hypothermia is defined as two or more temperature measurements less than or equal to 95.9 degrees Cefr, that's AAE 6.0 degrees Cefr,
okay.
Or similar to the fever definition, two or more measurements documenting a decrease in temperature of more than 2 degrees Cefr or 1.1 degrees C from their baseline. It's often a sign of an overwhelming infection.
Okay. If you can't remember everything, remember this. Infection in older adults often lacks typical signs. Suspicion should be high for new fever, hypothermia, delirium, or new hyperglycemia, but not for isolated nonspecific changes like confusion or falls. And definitely adapt your fever and hypothermia thresholds based on baseline. So you've now established a high suspicion for infection, maybe based on some of those subtle signs or revised definitions, and you're thinking about treatment. Antibiotic management in older adults isn't just about picking the right drug, is it? It sounds like navigating a truly complex pharmacologic landscape. What are the key considerations?
Indeed. Age-related pharmacokinetic changes are significant really across the board. They impact how drugs are absorbed, distributed, metabolized, and eliminated.
Okay, let's break that down. Absorption.
For absorption, it's often diminished. This can be due to increased gastric pH or reduced gut motility. It means an oral antibiotic might not reach therapeutic levels as expected.
So what you give orally might not be absorbed as well as in a younger patient. That's crucial.
It's exactly. Distribution is also influenced by changes in body composition. Serum proteins, cardiac output, all shift with age.
Right.
And crucially, elimination, especially hepatic and renal metabolism, is usually impacted, primarily due to decreased glomerular filtration rate, or GFR.
Oh, the GFR.
Obviously, the GFR.
Yeah.
This means drugs tend to stay in the system longer, increasing the risk of toxicity if doses aren't adjusted. Plus, you have to consider adherence.
Right. Can they actually take the meds?
Exactly. Cognitive function, impaired senses, polypharmacy making it confusing, side effects putting them off.
Yeah.
It all plays a role.
And the common resident dilemma, that urge to just throw some broad spectrum antibiotics at it when things are unclear.
Yeah, we need to be really judicious. Inappropriate prescribing is unfortunately very common in older adults, sometimes due to lack of clear indications, sometimes overly broad spectrum, or just excessive duration.
So how do we choose?
Well, the choice of initial agent is generally similar to younger patients for many common infections. But you should consider broader empiric coverage in specific high-risk situations.
Like what?
Like if the patient resides in an institution, has had a recent hospitalization, is on dialysis, has had recent antibiotic exposure, or has indwelling devices like catheters or lines.
Okay.
Also, for seriously ill patients where you're worried about sepsis or severe pneumonia, broader coverage initially is often warranted.
And once you've started those empirics, what's that critical on the wards tip we need to remember?
It is absolutely critical to narrow the antibiotic regimen once cultures are available and sensitivities are known. You've got to de-escalate.
Why is that so important?
Well, it reduces the pressure driving antibiotic resistance. And very importantly, it lowers the risk of Clostridioides difficile infection, C. diff, which can be devastating in this population. Another major concern is drug interactions. You have to be vigilant. Many commonly prescribed antibiotics interact with medications frequently used by older adults.
Like
things like warfarin, antacids, H2 blockers, digoxin.
Mm.
The list goes on. And some interactions can be really complex, even biphasic.
Wow. So we can't just follow the start low, go slow rule that's common in geriatrics for many other medications.
Crucially, no. That start low, go slow rule for many geriatric meds does not apply to antibiotics.
Okay, say that again. Does not apply.
Does not apply. Maintaining therapeutic drug levels is essential for antibiotics to be effective and, importantly, to prevent resistance development. You must always dose based on estimated GFR, and you need to reassess that GFR throughout treatment.
Makes sense.
And honestly, consulting a pharmacist for dosing recommendations is highly recommended. They're invaluable here.
Absolutely.
And just one more point on dosing for concentration-dependent antibiotics, like fluoroquinolones, achieving levels far exceeding the MIC, the minimum inhibitory concentration.
Right, the lowest concentration that stops growth.
Exactly. Achieving levels well above that MIC is actually more critical for success in older adults than in younger ones. You need that higher peak.
Got it. Higher peaks for concentration-dependent drugs. And are there specific times we should be monitoring drug levels?
Yes, especially for antibiotics with a narrow therapeutic index like aminoglycosides, particularly when you know the GFR is reduced. You need to monitor levels to avoid both toxicity and subtherapeutic dosing.
Right, it's a balancing act. And tying into all this is antibiotic stewardship, which sounds particularly vital in this population.
Oh, absolutely vital. Institutionalization, like living in a nursing home, is a major risk factor for multidrug-resistant organisms, MRSA, VRE.
Scary stuff.
It is. Studies show over 50% of nursing home residents might carry a drug-resistant organism. So, key stewardship strategies include things we've touched on. Avoiding treatment of asymptomatic bacteriuria.
The big one.
The big one. Also, specifically discussing antibiotic use and end-of-life care, what are the goals? And always focusing on the shortest effective duration of therapy. Don't just keep them going for 10 days because that's the default.
Okay. If you can't remember everything, remember this. Antibiotic dosing in older adults is complex due to altered pharmacokinetics. Always consider GFR, check interactions, and narrow therapy when cultures are back. Prioritize antibiotic stewardship to combat resistance, especially in institutionalized patients. And remember, start low, go slow does not apply here. All right, let's transition now to some of the most common infections you'll actually encounter on rounds and how they uniquely manifest in older adults, starting with, well, the one you'll probably see every single day.
You got it. First up, the ubiquitous urinary tract infection, or UTI. It's the most common infection in older adults, hands down. But there's a huge pitfall here.
I'm guessing it has to do with how often we see positive urine cultures without clear symptoms, that asymptomatic bacteria you mentioned.
Precisely. There's an incredibly high prevalence of asymptomatic bacteria.
Hmm.
We're talking 15-20% in community-dwelling older women.
15-20%.
Yeah, and it jumps to 25-54% in nursing home women. And it's almost 100% in patients with chronic indwelling catheters.
Wow.
This leads to just massive overdiagnosis and completely unnecessary antibiotic treatment.
Okay, so the on-the-wards tip here must be absolutely crucial then.
Absolutely crucial. Do not reflexively check a urine for non-specific symptoms. Things like isolated mental status changes, functional decline, or behavioral changes.
Just because they're confused doesn't mean you need a UA.
Exactly. Urine testing is only recommended in the presence of classic UTI symptoms. Think acute dysuria, new or worsening urgency or frequency, new incontinence, gross hematuria, suprapubic or CVA tenderness.
Okay, those specific urinary symptoms.
Yes, or if they have physiologic signs of serious acute illness, like fever meeting those criteria we discussed, vital sign abnormalities, or changes in level of consciousness.
Got it.
Because treating asymptomatic bacteriuria in patients who are just confused or falling does not improve outcomes. It does nothing for them. And it actively drives antibiotic resistance and increases C. diff risk. Remember, patients with dementia have normal behavioral fluctuations. A positive urine culture, which is common anyway, can get erroneously linked to these fluctuations, leading to these repeated, useless cycles of antibiotics.
And the tests themselves aren't perfect either.
No. Urinalysis results, like pyuria or leukocyte esterase, have low specificity for actual infection in older adults. And bacteria seen on culture doesn't automatically equate to infection, partly due to the normal urinary microbiome.
That makes so much sense. It's a paradigm shift, really. So if the diagnosis is truly in doubt, maybe they have some vague symptoms but aren't seriously ill, what's a reasonable strategy?
Well, deferring antibiotics for maybe a week with close follow-up is a perfectly reasonable strategy.
Really? Just watch and wait.
Yeah. Shockingly, some studies show 25-50% of older women with some UTI-like symptoms will actually improve without therapy. So avoid just giving antibiotic trials to see if they get better. There's just no clinical benefit to treating asymptomatic bacteriuria. And there are significant potential side effects from the antibiotics themselves. Things like renal insufficiency with TMP, SMX, confusion, or tendinitis with ciprofloxacin, pulmonary toxicity with nitrofurantoin.
Right. These aren't benign drugs.
Not at all. Right. Now, if a true UTI is diagnosed based on those criteria,
yeah,
management is generally the same as the general population. E. coli, Klebsiella pneumoniae, Enterococcus faecalis are still the most common culprits. And you don't need an extended treatment duration just because of age alone. Standard duration's fine.
Okay, super helpful on UTIs. Let's move to pneumonia. We know incidence and mortality increase with age. What are the key challenges here?
Well, again, inappropriate diagnosis is common, especially linking it solely to altered mental status without other signs. And while age is a factor in prognostic formulas like the Pneumonia Severity Index, PSI, or CURB65, your clinical judgment remains paramount. You have to consider things like social support, their ability to take oral medications, their living conditions, and any cognitive or functional impairment when deciding on admission or site of care.
And the bugs, are they different?
Streptococcus pneumonia is still predominant, but you do see polymicrobial infections and gram-negative organisms more commonly, especially in patients with COPD or those residing in long-term care facilities.
So maybe broaden empiric coverage in those specific cases.
Exactly. Consider broadening your empiric coverage if those risk factors are present. And don't forget prevention. The influenza and pneumococcal vaccines are absolutely vital tools here.
Good point. What about bacteremia? Does that also present subtly?
It often does. It can have a more subtle presentation, maybe less in the way of chills, sweating, or high fever. So maintain a low threshold for getting blood cultures if you suspect sepsis, even without all those classic signs, but especially if you see tachycardia or hypotension.
And the source.
GI and GU sources are very common culprits for bacteremia in older adults, as are gram-negative rods in general. Unfortunately, bacteremia does carry a poorer prognosis with advanced age.
Okay. And infective endocarditis, that's always a tough diagnosis.
It is, and older adults have about a five-fold higher risk than the general population. Often it's related to degenerative valvular disease or prosthetic valves.
And the presentation, still tricky.
Very tricky. Diagnosis is difficult and often delayed because of those atypical presentations. Fewer classic signs like high fever, marked leukocytosis, or obvious embolic events.
And imaging. Echocardiograms.
Echo can be challenging too, maybe due to heavily calcified valves or existing prostheses obscuring the view. This is why a low threshold for ordering a transesophageal echocardiogram, TEE, is warranted.
Even with the risks of sedation.
Even with the potential risks of sedation, especially in cognitively impaired patients. The diagnostic yield of TEE for endocarditis is often much higher and can be critical for making the diagnosis, so it's often worth considering carefully.
Okay, important point on TEE. Just briefly before we wrap up this section, what about some of the less common but still critical syndromes that clinicians might miss in older adults?
Yeah, maybe two quick ones to keep in mind are fever of unknown origin, FUO, and HIV.
FUO.
For FUO, when the usual infectious workup is negative, remember to broaden your differential considerably. Think about non-infectious inflammatory causes like giant cell arteritis or polymyalgia rheumatica, which can present atypically in older adults, maybe just with fever or constitutional symptoms.
Right, the great mimickers. And HIV.
HIV is often underdiagnosed in older adults simply because clinicians may not think to test for it. There might be assumptions about risk factors. And when it is diagnosed, managing it becomes complex due to polypharmacy and the significant potential for drug interactions between antiretrovirals, and the patient's other medications.
Okay, good reminders. So if you can't remember everything from this common syndrome section, remember this. For UTIs, resist the urge to treat isolated confusion or asymptomatic bacteriuria. Know the classic symptom criteria for testing. For pneumonia, consider broadening your bug coverage in specific high-risk patients, LTCF, COPD. Maintain a high index of suspicion for IE, and don't hesitate to consider T early. And keep GCAPMR and HIV on your radar.
Wow, this deep dive has really highlighted just how complex and, well, nuanced caring for older adults with infections can be. It really demands a different approach, doesn't it? A sharper eye, and definitely a willingness to challenge our usual assumptions.
Absolutely. So let's try to put it all together, walk through a quick scenario. Imagine you're covering the inpatient ward. Mrs. Henderson, she's 92, has advanced dementia and chronic incontinence. She's been increasingly agitated over the past 24 hours.
Okay, classic scenario. Right. Her oral temperature is 99.1 degrees Arenot, that's 37.3 degrees CT, and her baseline is typically around 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. She has no cough, and no dysuria is reported by staff.
So, given everything we just discussed, what's your very first thought? Or maybe what's the very first reflex you should question here?
Okay, well, based on what we said, the immediate reflex for many of us would be agitated, incontinent, maybe slightly warm, got to be UTI, let's send the urine. That's the pitfall, right?
Yeah.
Assuming a UTI just because of the behavioral changes in incontinence.
Exactly. You want to actively avoid that reflex urinalysis unless those specific criteria for UTI are truly met. So instead of jumping straight to labs, what physical exam findings would you prioritize looking for to guide your next steps?
Right. I'd want to look for suprapubic tenderness, maybe CVA tenderness, check her vitals carefully for tachycardia or hypotension, look for signs of dehydration.
Good. And what non-infectious causes should you be considering first before even really entertaining infection, given her baseline dementia and this presentation of agitation? Oh, yeah, definitely. Things like pain, constipation, medication side effects, environmental changes, delirium from another cause.
Excellent. And finally, how are you interpreting that 99.1 degree affective temperature, given her 98.6 degrees affective baseline, in the context of our revised fever definitions?
Well, 99.1 isn't over 100, but it is a rise of 0.5 degrees affarum from baseline. We said a rise of 2 degrees affar or 1.1 degrees C was significant. So 0.5 degrees affar is maybe borderline. It adds a little to the suspicion, but isn't definitive on its own. I'd want to recheck it and see if it persists or climbs.
Perfect. See how working through it systematically changes the initial approach. Mm-hmm. It's about being thoughtful and not jumping to conclusions.
Absolutely. So what does this all mean for your daily practice for the listeners out there on the wards? It means embracing this complexity, looking for those subtle shifts, using those revised definitions, and really advocating for thoughtful, evidence-based care that's tailored to the unique vulnerabilities of our older patients.
And we've focused heavily today on diagnosis and treatment, which is critical. But maybe here's a provocative thought to leave you with. Beyond just treating the acute infection itself, what are the often overlooked long-term functional consequences of any serious infection in older adults? Think about loss of mobility, worsening cognition, increased frailty, and how can we maybe start to factor that potential downstream impact into our initial management plans and the broader goals of care conversations we have?
That's a really important point. It's not just about curing the bug, it's about preserving function long term. Well, we hope this deep dive from 88 Diagnoses equips you to be a more discerning and effective clinician when faced with potential infection in your older patients. Go forth, apply these lessons on rounds, challenge those automatic reflexes, and share your experiences. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time, keep diving deep.